So, welcome to the Saturday morning Sangha talk. This is what time is it in Chicago, Damodas? Friday evening.
It is 8:08.
8:08. Okay.
Yeah. So,
all right. So. Let's talk today about the Eightfold Path, as you described it. And as context, what I'd like to start off with is that though the Buddha started off with an Eightfold Noble Path, it has devolved over the centuries into two different paths, an Eightfold Path for ordinary people and an Eightfold Noble Path for those who know the noble way. Now, in the Eightfold Ordinary Path, it's broken down into three groups: Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. In other words, Sila starts first. The precepts start first. They teach children the precepts in Thailand, and then Westerners, when they come, for some reason the Thai people forget all about English common law and the Ten Commandments and all of that that Westerners have as an ordinary law-giving system. And so they introduce the precepts as if it were brand new, like to children. So we can discuss now why there is a difference between the Eightfold Path and the Eightfold Noble Path. The Eightfold Noble Path also has three divisions, and that is Panya, Samadhi, Sila. Notice the difference in the order. Sila, Samadhi, Panya for the beginner or the ordinary person, the Thai who is Buddhist and goes to the temple and all of that. So you could also say that the Eightfold Path is also for lay people who have no intention of either ordaining or coming into the noble perspective. And so they start with Sila. They start with a set of rules. They start with precepts or morality as a set of rules. Now, here's an interesting point that we can say that the Ten Commandments were given. The precepts are given. The law is made by lawmakers, who, and seems to be no end to the number of laws that they want to make. But laws are made for ignorant people, not the wise. That in fact, wisdom requires no rules, no laws, no precepts. And we'll talk about why that's true in just a moment. But for the beginner, every child is given precepts, and if they were not given precepts in their ignorance, they would destroy our civilization. That every child is a barbarian. Every child is a greedy little tyrant. And that the socialization process then is putting boundaries or limits on the child. And in our cultures, that's almost always overdone. But there's got to be a balance someplace. There is no such thing as a perfect child or a perfect childhood, mainly because nobody has been able to find the exact correct balance of how to raise a child. And so we either wind up being too permissive or too strict. And at the same time, we're strict in some areas and permissive in others, leaving the child in a state of confusion. there's almost impossible to say that there is a correct way to raise a child, that every one of us is traumatized. Every one of us is screwed up in our childhood in this regard of what are going to be the rules. Hello, David. We're going to be talking about the Eightfold Path and its cousin, distant cousin, the Eightfold Noble Path. And so I'm starting off with the Eightfold Path that starts off as Sila Samatipanya. And every child is started off in all societies by giving them a set of rules to do, things that they're told to do. Things like take a bath, pick up your toys, brush your teeth, put your clothes on, fix your hair, do your ABCs, do your 1, 2, 3s, go to school. And for some reason, children always rebel against these rules. It's almost like every child knows that he can break all the rules and get away with it. But then he gets caught eventually. And so this actually brings out in the Eightfold Noble Path the issue of right view. And in the ordinary path, you have a right view and an ordinary right view and a wrong view. And the wrong view is that I can get away with it. I can hurt people. I can ignore my responsibilities. I can do anything that I want to. I can even join a gang because the guys in the gang for sure can get away with anything. So the whole idea of the ordinary right view is to say to the children and those who are, you know, in adult bodies but still have the attitude of I can get away with it, and their answer to that is, oh no, you can't. Now in the sutta, this is talked about in the sense of the wrong view is that there is no mommy and daddy. Nobody can tell me what to do. There is no this world and the next world. Even the comma machine is not going to tell me what to do. There is no monks and saints that really know how things are supposed to be, and so I'll make up my own mind and decide to live my life the way that I want to. Actually, in politics, leads to liberalism. Oh, let's help everybody. Let's build roads and infrastructure and put up power systems and give everybody high-speed internet and give everybody $1,000 a month and all kinds of liberal things, thinking that there's no cost to that, that they can get away with doing all of these services. And then the ordinary right view is much more politically conservative in the sense of, oh no, you gotta pay for everything. Everything cost. You can't get away with anything. And that they would be the ones who says we need police, we need government, we need a method to make sure that those crooks can't get away with it. And if all of that fails, we'll get a religion, we'll get a priest, we'll dig people up just so that we can tear them up. Okay. And so the whole idea of conservatism is that it's long-lasting way into the future. And this is the ordinary view that's based upon sila, or precepts, or laws, rules, rituals, all of that kind of stuff. Now, for the ordinary people, that's a requirement. You got to pay your taxes. You got to do this. You got to do that. You got to get up in the morning. But the noble position is based upon wisdom, not based upon a set of rules. And that, in fact, for the teaching of the Buddha actually says that these rules, we attach to them we want these rules, and that that actually prevents us from moving into the noble path. It's called Sila Bhatta Paramasa. Now, here's an interesting thing, and that is that who we are is defined by the rules that we live by and our relationship to those rules. Now, in modern psychology, Eric Byrne changed Freud's position. He talked about, Freud talked about ego, superego, and id. And Eric Byrne talks about it in the sense of parent, adult, and child. Well, you could see then that the adult in the room is wisdom. But our self, who we are and what we want to do, is the child within. And then all of these rites, rules, rituals, things to do, the society requirements, this is called the parent ego state. And that there is a basic conflict within each person. The conflict is between the rules and what I want to do. My relationship to the rules. And these wind up being the first two fetters. Personality view, who I am, and Sila Bhatta Paramasa, my relationship to how things are supposed to be according to the rules. And ordinary people then are going to be stuck in this dichotomy between how things are supposed to be and how I want them to be. And often how I want them to be is according to the rules that we make up. And the other times, and most of the time, how I want things to be is based upon how I feel. So if I like something, then I want it. And if I want it bad enough, I should be able to have it no matter who I hurt to get it, including myself. In fact, wanting things and then having things and in getting things means that we like it, it must be good. And if we don't like it, it must be bad. Wow. In that regard, what we can say is that all these rites, rules, rituals, laws, precepts, commandments, and all of that kind of stuff is actually based upon feelings anyway. It's based upon I don't like it. I don't like it that the blacks are discriminated against, as an example. Therefore, let's hate Republicans because they discriminate against blacks. So these are the mentalities that cause our rites, rules, and rituals. And then later, after the rules are made, our relationship to these rules define who we are as a person. In other words, each one of you, David, you are not you, the David inside. You are a relationship between how you think things ought to be and how you want things to be.
I don't even know who I am anymore, to be honest.
That's the whole point. You're not.
I'm not.
No, you're not. Other than this relationship between feelings and the rules and how things are supposed to be. But wisdom will point out that, in fact, you're a moving target. You're not fixed. The answer then would be, I don't know who I am right now, because the next minute I'll be something new. And what defines personality and makes it rigid then is the rule systems about how things are supposed to be and our relationship to those rules. In other words, the child's relationship to the parent within his own mind defines who we are and fixes the personality. And this is what happens with ordinary people. Now, in that path of the Sila, then Samadhi, and then Panya, is the idea that Oh, you have to be a good little kid. You have to go to the Wat and sit down and practice meditation or Anapanasati or something and start collecting the mind together so that you can begin to see things the way that they actually are rather than seeing things through the lens of how they're supposed to be and how I want them to be. And we begin to see through samadhi about gathering realities, we begin to see reality. And so when we can see reality as it is, this is then the shift to panya, to wisdom. So the ordinary path that people are on starts with sila, starts with the rules, then starts with checking things out, and then they come to the point of panya, and that's the beginning then of the noble path, which is based upon panya or wisdom. So it becomes panya, samadhi, sila. And let's describe what that means now, okay? Because what happens with that shift into wisdom is an attitude change, a view change. You see, the ordinary mind state, the view, which is between what I want and what I know should be, which is the ordinary right view and ordinary wrong view, we begin to change that from a noun into a verb. Okay, what do I mean by that? Well, a noun would be a worldview, a point of view, a way that we look at things. And then the verb has to do with an actual investigation. This is what has to get started. People have to start looking at things the way that they actually are. We begin to start living in reality because we can see it moment by moment. And this is what we mean by noble right view. And noble right view is the starting of the noble path, the actual seeing how things are. And with that, we can begin to look at the Eightfold Noble Path now according to the way that the Buddha would talk about it, knowing that the ordinary path is kind of upside down. It starts with sila. It winds up with wisdom, but then that's the change to the noble path. The wisdom is the ability to look and the remembrance to look. In other words, most people, even those noble students who are on the noble path, spend most of their mind moments in the ordinary. And it's only when we're actually looking at the way things actually are is when we're in a noble state. And by watching what's going on and seeing what's going on, we begin to make a determination that the way that I thought things should be and the way that I wanted things to be is actually unwholesome. And that we can now begin to change that from something that's unwholesome into something that's real. And this is where the Eightfold Noble Path really starts to kick in, with the idea of remembering to look. You have to keep remembering to look, because ordinarily we will fall back into an ordinary existence. So we have to remember to start looking to see how things actually are. And then the third item on the list of the Eightfold Noble Path is to make a change, to make the right effort to come out of the unwholesome, out of the ordinary, into the noble, into the wholesome, into reality. An example would be that a lot of people right now in the world are worried about something or another. They're worried about the war in Ukraine. They're worried about the war in this country or that country. They're worried about political wars. They're worried about the IRS. They're worried about the war they're having at home. They're worried about the war within. All of this conflict. And the reality is right now, Michael, you sitting here on the porch, there is really nothing dangerous. There is no war. The reality is that there is no war, but within the minds of all of these people, there's all of these various conflicts. And the primary conflict is the conflict of my relationship to the rules that I have made up or I have learned from other people. And so it's my relationship to my own rules that is the conflict. And when I come out of the conflict into reality, the reality is everything is okay, everything is safe, everything is secure right now. So why then don't I live in a safe, secure world? Just go about doing what needs to be done happily. This is actually then coming out of the ordinary life into the noble. Now, as we continue to practice this over and over again, something amazing begins to happen. We begin to change our attitude. Now, I haven't talked about attitude yet, so let's go back and review the attitude of an ordinary person that has their personality defined by their relationship between what they want and what the rules are. There are actually then everybody winds up feeling like a victim to the rules. I'm a victim of the way things are supposed to be because things are not the way they're supposed to be. Oh, poor me. And also I want things to be a certain way and they're not that way. Oh, poor me. And so we all start off as a victim. Every child is victimized. That in fact, when we're born, we have to be nurtured and taken care of. Unlike an elephant or a giraffe or a horse, when they're born, a deer, when it's born, can stand up and start walking around. But a human baby, it takes us, what, a couple of years, 18 months or so, to figure out even how to walk. And so for the first 18 months, we're pretty much victimized, have to be carried around. And while we're being, let us say, indoctrinated into the system, we are also victimized. And so we wind up with this victim's mentality. And the victim's mentality is I don't get what I want and things are not the way they're supposed to be. And this is the attitude that we are born with and grow up with and live adult life with. This is the ordinary lifestyle. Then, in fact, you could go so far as to say that everybody suffers under post-traumatic stress disorder. The stress actually is that conflict between what we want and what it should be, and that it brings upon a trauma and stress, and we live our lives in a disorderly way. So everybody has a post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, not just people in the Army. Everyone has that, and it's called victimhood. I am still being stressed out about something that happened a long time ago. The stresses or the trauma is over, post-traumatic, and I'm stressed out. All right, this is the victim's position. But the reality in right now, there you are, Damodas, laying in bed, feeling comfortable. You really got no stress. You're all right already, right this very minute. David, you're okay right now. We can dream up all kinds of stress. We can dream up all kinds of problems, because we're in the habit of doing that as victims, but the current reality is that we're all right. If we keep practicing that and coming to the reality of the situation, that everything is fine, everything is all right, we begin to shift that attitude from being a victim into being a winner, because everything is all right. You've made your environment to such that everything is okay. Now, one of the things that we don't really understand, we feel like we're a victim of circumstances, and yet everybody creates the circumstances that they're in. In other words, David, you found your way to White Cow Tom. Michael, you found your way to this porch. I found my way to, and I know for sure that I'm on Copenhagen because that's the best place for me. According to my attitudes, my wants, my desires, it's safe. We got no problems with storms. We got no problems with nuclear bombs. We got no problems with racism. We got no problems with the cops. We got no problems with insurance. We got no problems with anything at all. Everything is hunky-dory because I set things up that way. And so you set your life up according to your plans, your desires, your wants, and the way things should be. And anything that it doesn't do the way that you want it to, that brings back up that stress. But when you practice correctly, to keep recognizing that right now, everything actually is okay. There is no problems. We begin to change or shift our attitude out of being a victim into being a winner, being a noble, in fact. Ordinary people are victims, and nobles are the winners. They're the ones that don't get involved in all of the conflicts. In fact, I would stop a moment just to define the word noble. In the Pali, the word is Aryan, and that the word Aryan generally has to do with aristocrats or very wealthy people who don't have to work. They don't have to slave. But that word actually has a better use for it in the sense of elements, noble elements. An example is gold. You know that they can have gold that was on a ship, and the ship had a storm and it was lost at sea hundreds of years ago. And then the divers find the gold. Everything about that ship has rotted away. The shoes rot, the clothing rots, the flesh rots. Everything rots, but the gold remains gold. It doesn't turn into gold oxide. It doesn't turn into gold nitrates. It remains gold. What that also, there are other noble elements. An example would be radon, xenon, krypton, not kryptonite, by the way, krypton, and argon. Argon's my favorite. Argon. Let us say that they have complete cycles of valence electrons to where iron has an excess and oxygen has a depletion. And so iron and oxygen will immediately come together making ferrous oxide. Hydrogen is like that. Hydrogen and oxygen will easily bond together. But argon doesn't bond with anything because it's whole, it's complete. And when we begin to change our attitude, you see, the victim is not complete. We're out there looking for something. We're looking for validation. We're looking for love. And we're often looking for love in all the wrong places. But when you become whole, when the world is okay the way that it is and doesn't need to be changed, we gain this noble attitude. The attitude is, I don't need anything. Everything is cool. Everything is exactly the way that it ought to be. This in the Eightfold Noble Path, by the way, is called Samasankapa. And it also has a twin word, Sada or Shraddha, which actually means confidence. That we know how things are. And because we know how things are, we gain the confidence that we can, in fact, live a complete, whole samadhi life. Just like argon and gold have just the right number of electrons so that they don't interfere and make compounds, but they're whole and unified all by themselves. this is actually the goal then of the Eightfold Noble Path, is to gain that nobility, to gain that ability to not interfere, interact, or mess around with the world. While everybody out in the world is messing around, interacting, looking for connections, etc., like that, because they're ordinary elements. So can you become noble? Can you gain whatever it is that you need so that you become complete and whole unto yourself? This is, by the way, what the word samati means. Samati means organized unification. You got all you need. And this is the fifth element of the Eightfold Noble Path. So we start with being able to investigate and to look at what's going on, to see reality that it is. We remember to keep doing this over and over again so that we can see the reality as it is. We make a change so that we conform with reality. And when we do that enough, we become confident. Our attitude changes. And when that attitude changes, we become unified, whole. And this is then the samadhi. The samadhi is unification of mind. It's not just about being quiet and sitting on the floor doing nothing. It has to do with that stillness that comes with investigation, so that we stop interacting with things. And now we have a natural kind of samadhi, that we have peace and quiet on the inside because we're not out there looking for validation. We're not looking for love. We're not looking for connections or interactions or compounding things. We can, in fact, go out in the world and be in the world, but not interact with the world. Jesus said, be in the world, but not of the world. Well, what being of the world means that you're interacting with the world. You want things from it. Rather than doing just what you need to do, you wind up having a lot of feelings about how it should be and how I want it to be, rather than just dealing with it the way it actually really is. Okay, so we've now covered five elements. By the way, you guys can ask questions anytime. I see Michael's just on the edge of the seat. What you got on your mind, Michael?
I was just going to mention that being of the world can also, being of the world can also mean that the world is making decisions for you and choosing how you live your life. And whenever we have the lion's attitude, we don't have to let the world make choices for us or decide what we need in order to be happy.
Well, if you think of it one way, let us talk about it in the sense of, because several of us are in Thailand, we have to deal with visas, right? Visas are part of the reality of being here. But if we say, oh, visas are an imposition that the Thai government makes, now we become a victim of it.
Yeah.
All right, so don't become a victim of reality. See, reality is just reality, and then we deal with reality happily. That's an important point, that yes, the world presents things to us in the sense of reality, but if we've got rules, oh, the Thai government shouldn't do this, oh, we should, the world does not need passports, anybody should go any place they want to go, until they come on my porch. And so you get that there ought to be no visas. But then when that no visa, no passport interferes with what I want, now I'm back into conflict again. But the reality is that you're in Thailand. The reality is there are visas. Can you deal with visas happily? That's the question. In other words, can you remain noble? You don't have to interact in the sense of your feelings interacting with the visas. You can just step around dance around the visa, get the things done that need to be done, because they're real. All right. So in this reality, then, we have five aspects of the Eightfold Noble Path. Right view. We have then right sati, which is to remember, to keep coming back to having a right view, which means a right investigation, not a viewpoint, not an attitude, but an actual investigative view. That in fact, all the ordinary people live their life according to a view about how things are supposed to be, and that's back into the set of laws, rules, rituals, as opposed to reality. So the reality is that some people live according to a set of rules. But we don't have to live according to a set of rules. We can live according to reality. So with that sati and change of attitude, with a change of right effort into seeing reality as it is and not interfering with it, we gain that attitude of a winner. I'm a champion of reality. Reality cannot make me suffer. Any time that I'm suffering is because I don't like reality and I want to change it. I'm a victim of reality because it's not good enough according to my standards or my desires. But when reality is just reality, I can deal with that. All right, so this is the beginning of the noble mind, that Samasankappa. I'm on top of the world. This gives us then that organization, okay, the samati. So it goes from ditti sati to virya, then to Samasankappa, and then into samati. We are now unified. We're organized. True nobility has set in. These are five aspects of the Eightfold Noble Path. And now that we have panya, the ability to investigate, and samati, the ability to remain whole, now we can deal with those last three, the sila. Now, I'm going to start off with the sila in this sense. And that is that if you are nobly minded in this moment and you have no desire, you're free, you don't want anything, you're very unlikely to go kill somebody to get it. The nobility now prevents you from doing the things that you used to have a rule about in order to stop you from doing it. Rules with punishments, rules with regulations and outcomes and punishments and all of that. Now, we don't need that world. That's the ordinary world of interaction. Now that we have the noble mind, we don't want anything. If you don't want anything, you're unlikely to go steal it. You got everything you need. You got everything you want. You can deal with reality as it is, happily. We also don't go messing around in the sense of, let us say, sexual impropriety, adultery. The precept, kame sumi chatara, means that we stay away from that kind of stuff because it's dangerous as a precept. But now, we don't go messing around because we don't need to mess around. We're already okay. I'm not looking for love in all the wrong places. And so sila becomes a natural outcome. Also, right speech would be that if I'm okay the way that I am and I'm enjoying, even though that I've done something to harm somebody, I'm going to be honest about it. We stop lying because the truth will do. Reality is good enough. But if we are in fact set up in a set of rules, the rules are the things that allow us or actually force us in many cases to actually lie. Why? Because I don't want to go against the rules. So I'll lie my way around it. But if you have a noble mind, then the truth is good enough. Reality is good enough. Our precepts then are no longer a set of rules that we have, but rather an attitude, a way of looking at things, seeing things the way that they really are, and having that noble mind state that gives us that unification of mind. And then we don't go around hurting ourselves or other people. So this is the Eightfold Noble Path, including these last three, about right actions and right speech and right livelihood. We don't go around doing things like selling people stuff that they don't need, like selling weapons, selling alcohol, selling anything, in fact, that anybody doesn't need is not right livelihood. What is right livelihood is when everybody benefits. Everybody benefits. It's a win-win-win situation. That's what right livelihood is really all about. And so this is the Eightfold Noble Path. When it's noble, it starts with wisdom. It integrates the mind into a noble, integrated mind that doesn't need any set of rules, to where the ordinary Eightfold Path is the path of, we need to start with the rules because we don't have enough wisdom to figure out what is the right noble way of doing things. And so the rules come first. And then the rules come out. Here's an example of that in construction, for example. They use a lot of concrete, not just in Thailand, but all over the world. But you can't order a cement truck to just come pour cement out on the pavement or out on the yard, and that's your house. Oh, I ordered a cement truck, and he poured cement all over the yard. Is that my house? No. We have to have forms. We have to have scaffolding. We have to have a structure so that when we pour the concrete and then the concrete sets, the structures, the forms come off. And then we're left with the house. Can anybody think of any other analogies to where we need the form? An example of that would be tie-dye. Have you ever seen people wearing tie-dyed clothes? You have to actually bind it up, put rubber bands or string and tighten it up like that, and then put it in the various dyes. But after you finish the dye, you can't wear that shirt when it's all bound up. You got to take it, the forms, got to take the strings and the rubber bands off of it so that now the shirt can be worn. If you can understand those simple concepts and you can understand how this thing gets started, in the sense that we have to start with the forms, we have to start with the rites, rules, rituals, and all of that. But once we become noble, that means that things have become rigid and real, and now the forms can come off and you can start living your life in reality. Another way of saying it is that the strength of the concrete is that it's set. And the mind can become noble. It becomes set in the sense of, we only need one rule now. And what rule is that? The rule of dukkha, dukkha nirodha. This is actually then the fulfillment of the actual teaching of the Buddha. The Eightfold Noble Path and the Four Noble Truths all wrap around this one point of living our lives, in the sense of, when you see dukkha, avoid it. Don't go around harming people. That's what the precepts and that's what all of the rules and laws are supposed to be anyway, is don't harm things because there's going to be retribution. But now we don't harm things because we don't need to harm things. Why bother to go around harming things? We just don't have any harm for anything. Because we're already ordinary. I mean, we're already good enough. We're already noble. So, Dhammadas, does this give you a fairly good explanation of the Eightfold Noble Path as opposed to the Eightfold Path?
Yes. Definitely.
Aaron, you came in a little bit late. Do you have any questions?
No questions, but as you were talking about that and with my practice too, you always say something like, I like something, but I don't want it. And I was realizing the reverse of it is also true. You don't like something, but you don't also, you know, struggle with it.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's in fact an important place that Bhikkhu Buddhadasa talks about. And that is when we have wisdom at the point of contact. In other words, when that skirt or those panties contact your eyes, it's not the panties or the skirt that contacts your eyes. It's your attitude or it's your desire or it's what you think about those panties that contact the way you feel. And if you can see that, then you can recognize I've got a choice about it. Yes, I like it, but I don't have to do anything about it. Or I don't like it, but I don't have to do anything about it. In other words, it doesn't affect me. The noble mind state is that I can like something without wanting it. I don't have to chase it. So, if we don't have to chase anything, we can like and not like. We can go around the world seeing things that I like and I don't like and whatnot like that, but my feelings are not important. What's important is that I don't go into wanting things. But there is now something else that we can do, and that is that we can actually choose how we feel. In other words, you can see something and you don't have to like it. You can see something and you don't have to not like it. And in fact, you can feel the way that you want to feel. Why? Because your feelings are no longer biological. Your feelings are now based in wisdom. And you can choose to feel the way that you want to feel. It's always your choice. It always has been. We just didn't know that we had a choice. But by practicing having a choice over and over again about everything, including the way that we feel, we can begin to feel the way that we want to. We don't have to go around making feelings based upon how things should be or what I want. Instead, we can have our feelings great because they conform to reality, and reality is good enough, so I can feel good enough. That's my choice. And then we can go even further and begin to change the way that we perceive things, the way things interact with the mind, so that we have a choice about, am I going to leave things as reality or am I going to add something to it? Because we always get our feelings from what we've added to reality. And so we actually now can come more and more close to living our lives according to reality, according to the senses, according to our consciousness, and not so much living our lives according to our perceptions and our feelings. Because this is the practice, this is the training. Is to train ourselves to not feel the way that we have been feeling because of our habits and our old ways of doing things, that we, in this moment, can choose the way we feel. Go ahead, Michael.
I wasn't going to say anything, but thank you very much, Dhammarato. That was very well put.
Does anybody have any questions about this? David.
No questions.
All right. Okay. Any comments?
No, just a good to listen to the Dhamma talk.
So, Dhammadas, do you have any comments, any final things to say?
Nope, just thank you for everything. Thank you, everyone.
How about you, Aaron? I give you the last word.
Everything's okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, guys, it's been great. Thank you so much for giving us this opportunity to reestablish our noble mind. May you all have that noble mind. May you stop interacting with the world. Stop getting messed up with the world. Stop wanting things from the world and start living your life happily the way you want to, feeling on top of the world. That's the supramundane, the lokottara, is being on top of the world. Everybody's an emperor of their own pile of dirt. Your choice, are you going to be buried under your pile of dirt? Your choice, are you going to be digging your way out of your pile of dirt? Or is it going to be the attitude of, I'm on top of my pile of dirt? May you all live a life where you're free of your pile of dirt, your past. Michael, last words?
Yes, if anybody watching or with us here now would like to volunteer, well, we've certainly got some things that you can do to help our Sangha, such as logging in to our website, creating a profile, browsing around. You can also help us with data entry, YouTube videos, social media, or even on our Discord. We're looking for new moderators. So thank you very much, everyone.
Yes. Talk to Michael about volunteering. Thank you, Michael. We'll see you guys.